You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Monday, August 31st, 2020.
And I was really concerned to hear that Indiana University was still offering in-person classes.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti speaks with Brandy Heberlin, author of an opinion piece in the Indiana Daily Student titled "Reopening IU Puts Everyone in Harm's Way." The opinion piece said, "Students' presence in Bloomington will put more vulnerable people at risk." That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, A Few Minutes with the Mayor, where Mayor John Hamilton answers questions about recent criticism of the Bloomington Police Department and Greek organizations forced to quarantine after a spike in COVID-19 cases. But first, your local headlines.
Up first, here are three headlines you need to know today. Today's local news brief includes the latest COVID-19 numbers, the new coronavirus dashboard at Indiana University, and a summer send-off concert at Switchyard Park. WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti filed today's local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Monday, August 31st. I'm Aaron Comforti. For the second day in a row, Monroe County has broken its own record for newly diagnosed cases of COVID-19. On Sunday, the county reported 56 new cases, and on Saturday, it reported 38. The Indiana State Department of Health reported the second highest weekend tally to date, with 897 new cases on Sunday and another 866 on Saturday. Six new deaths were also reported over the weekend. Nearby, Greene County saw 5 new cases, while Lawrence County saw 3. Indiana University published its COVID-19 dashboard on Friday evening, shortly after it announced that 3 more Greek houses were being forced to quarantine. The data reflects Indiana University's testing results as of last week. Of the almost 34,000 test results, 344 tests were positive. That's about a 1% positivity rate. The university announced that it would update its dashboard today, but it has not yet done so. There is a summer send-off concert in the Performing Arts Series at the new Switchyard Park. The show will feature back-to-back concerts with Matushando and Kid Kazooie and the Ballroom Roustabouts. The send-off will be on Friday, September 4th from 5:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Tickets are free, but are required for admission. To register to attend the event, check out the Bloomington Parks website. There are a limited number of spaces available to accommodate physical distancing guidelines, and concert goers must wear masks. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Comforti.
Indiana University Professor of Pediatrics Aaron Carroll said approximately 1% of IU students tested positive for COVID-19 upon arrival to campus. Carroll said any infected student had to isolate.
We had students isolate if they were infected, meaning that they had to stay sheltering in place for 10 days until they have no more symptoms, if they had symptoms, and they had no more fever if they had fever. But for 10 days since their positive test, we also quarantined close contacts and continued to monitor them for any signs.
Carroll said a higher prevalence rate was found after retesting all on-campus students. He said IU and the county are working to increase isolation for campus living areas with an increased spread. Monroe County School Corporation Superintendent Judith DeMuth said MCCSC approved a comprehensive plan to begin in-person classes.
So our metric really is comprised of a percent positivity, positive cases per day on a 7-day rolling average, positive cases per day, 100,000 unit, and test turnaround and contact tracing, which really are important for our staff because at this point in time, we are planning on bringing back some of our students will start actually on August 31st, And then we'll have students returning on September 8th.
DeMuth said 10% of Indiana school corporations are still virtual. She said a red, yellow, and green system would determine the teaching method.
We superimposed on our metrics an actual green, yellow, red document that placed the learning status. So we're trying to make this easy. If we're in red, our students will be online. If we're in the green status, obviously we're good to go and all students can return. And then if we're in the yellow status, we'll be in a situation where our elementaries will be 5 days a week, and then we'll be in a hybrid at our secondary schools, splitting by alphabet so families can stay together.
DeMuth said students are not required to attend classes in person. County Health Administrator Penny Caudill said as of August 28th, Monroe County saw 1,030 positive COVID-19 tests. She said the 7-day positivity rate was 2.3%. Caudill said local sport events must follow the county gathering size limit.
The one thing that the Athletic Association did was put a cap of 250 per section, and that goes along with the state limit on sizes. However, locally, we have a limit of 150. So for those football games, outside events, each of those sections would have a maximum capacity of 150. Or 50%. And so it may vary depending on the size of the area.
Caudill said the county is working on future plans for COVID-19 vaccination clinics. President of IU Health South Central Region, Brian Shockney, said within 2 months, behavioral health service needs increased by 22%.
Worry and isolation, concern for our loved ones, and the personal fear that when you're sick cannot be underestimated. When we must take walks outside, that dog park would be a good place to go today. Take time away from technology and news, connect with our loved ones in meaningful ways, even if it's virtual, and seek professional help when we don't feel we can handle things on our own.
Shockney encouraged everyone to get a flu vaccination.
Today marks Overdose Awareness Day in the United States. In response, Hamilton County, Indiana becomes the first county in the state to install overdose boxes. According to Indiana University, every 2.5 hours, someone in Indiana is sent to the hospital for an opioid overdose. The state is one of four where the fatal overdose rate has quadrupled in the past 2 decades. Due to this rise, Indiana residents are more likely to die from an overdose than a car accident. Jim Ginder, health education specialist at the Hamilton County Health Department, told WRTV Indianapolis there have been 72 overdoses in the county since the start of this year.
Since January 1, as of yesterday, we've had about 72 overdoses within Hamilton County. So thanks to Steve Swartz and the grant that we've actually obtained, we're going to be able to hopefully lower those numbers of overdoses within the county as well, too.
The overdose boxes are funded by a grant from the Indiana Division of Mental Health and Addiction. Hamilton County Councilman Steve Schwartz, owner of Schwartz's Bait and Tackle, became the first business owner to sign up for the program. According to the Times, the county's daily newspaper, each overdose box contains gloves and 2 doses of Narcan, a nasal spray used to treat opioid overdoses. The Hamilton County Council on Alcohol and Other Drugs will provide the boxes to businesses for free and will refill the Narcan as it is used or expires.
A black bear spotted in North Kentucky may cross the Ohio River into Indiana, according to state wildlife officials. The Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife said the bear was located north of Prospect, Kentucky. That's just south of Clark County, Indiana, which is less than 20 miles from the Kentucky town separated by the Ohio River. Brad Westrich, a non-game mammalogist for the Indiana Department of Wildlife, told the Clark County-based News and Tribune, quote, "The sighting provides an opportunity for Hoosiers in the area to secure outdoor grills, trash cans, or pet and bird food," end quote. He said black bears prefer to avoid humans and that removing potential food sources goes a long way in preventing a negative interaction. Until 2015, there had not been a sighting of a bear in Indiana since 1871. Since 2015, there have been 3 confirmed sightings of bears in the state, according to the IDNR.
Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti talked to Brandy Heberlin, author of an opinion piece in the Indiana Daily Student titled "Reopening IU Puts Everyone in Harm's Way."
Brady Heberlin is a dual PhD student in geography and informatics at Indiana University, and they wrote an opinion piece for the IDS titled "Reopening IU Puts Everyone in Harm's Way. Students' presence in Bloomington will put more vulnerable people at risk." Thanks for coming on the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And firstly, I just wanted to say that the account of your experience getting COVID-19 that you published on Twitter sounded really hard. And I'm glad to hear that seems like you've recovered in a big way.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back. It was a rough 20 days or so. And of course, at that time, there wasn't really testing. So I couldn't know for sure, but all the symptoms, you know, lined up. So I was presumed positive.
Okay, so what inspired you to write the piece?
So I've been living in Bloomington for a little over 7 years now. So I'm, you know, a student who's sort of seen students come and go, seen undergraduates come and go by this point. And I was really concerned to hear that Indiana University was still offering in-person classes. You could see the city go from being relatively empty, restaurants being relatively empty, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're used to seeing all the sort of cars come in, but all of a sudden there were people walking around without masks. There were more people, the bars were full, for example. You could pass by any number of bars, especially on Walnut, and they would be packed. And so I wanted to write a piece that people who were thinking about this issue could read and have some more language for what was happening, have more language to describe why opening the university was such a bad idea.
Did any of your research in geography and informatics play into the lenses through which you wrote this piece and looked at these issues?
Yeah, I think in both fields, there is a sort of spatial element of thinking about the spread of anything, but especially a pandemic. In informatics, we talk about a complex system, for example, as being a system that's more than the sum of its parts. And so I was thinking about this not as a bunch of individual students who have to agree to wear their masks, but as a collective issue. A pandemic is a collective issue. So it's not just about putting the responsibility or irresponsibility on students. It's about actors who can define the setting, like the university, who have a lot of power, making decisions that set everyone else up for success. And what I was really seeing with the university is that they created a situation that sets a lot of people up for failure. And it especially sets up people who are of color, who are Black, Latino, etc., people who are immunocompromised. It's setting them up for failure. And it's unfair. It's not fair to them.
I talked with Dr. Aaron Carroll this morning, who's the university's director for surveillance and mitigation testing. And I asked him, basically, isn't it irresponsible for Indiana University to open up right now when we're seeing more diagnosed cases of COVID-19 per day, 200 more than back in April, let's say? And his answer was, the university is just a small player in this big picture, and that the state bears responsibility and that the federal government also bears responsibility as well. The university opening up is actually a service because it appears they will do more testing than the state as a whole. How would you respond to that?
I would respond to that and basically say that the pattern that we've seen throughout the tenure of COVID has been larger and larger sort of institutions of power pushing the responsibility further and further down so that the responsibility is being put on the people who have the least amount of power. And right now, those people are not only students who are bearing a large part of the responsibility, but also people who are already vulnerable to COVID. And that the university saying that and having a doctor who represents the university say that is a way of saying, we won't take, you know, our portion of the responsibility, in part because the state and federal government are pushing the responsibility down to the university. But then the university, rather than accept what of that responsibility they can, is pushing that responsibility onto the students and onto faculty and staff who have to, you know, wipe down their classes, who have to really go above and beyond to, you know, make up for the fact that the university is opening when it just shouldn't be opening.
The other thing that I think Dr. Aaron Carroll would bring up is that basically, yes, there is a increased risk with students being in class, but they don't really have control over whether students come or not. And so they might as well do the best they can and start a large testing regimen. Does that change your thoughts on it at all?
It doesn't really change my perspective on this because I am a fan of a practice called harm reduction, where you do whatever you can to get the most positive results, right? And not expecting students to show up on campus for classes and not creating an attractor, not creating a thing that draws students together is harm reduction. It would be an act of harm reduction to not invite students back to campus. And it would be really the university taking responsibility for being a hub, being about a third of Bloomington's population. It's by no means a small part of the Bloomington population. If the university went out of their way to offer students, you know, stipends for rent forgiveness so that they didn't have to return to the university or petition the city to do things like that, there really are creative ways the university could intervene so that they both weren't drawing students near campus or drawing students closer together, and also allow students out of some of the economic burdens that might make them say, you know, oh, well, I guess I'll go back to Bloomington. Because at the end of the day, it's not that we don't want students here. They bring a vibrant pulse of life to Bloomington. And of course, they're immensely central to the Bloomington economy. But also that movement right now between cities, between states, is just an irresponsible approach to COVID. We need people to sort of bunker down a little bit, stay where they are, you know, and be responsible for the fact that at the end of the day, you know, lives of elderly, lives of people who are immunocompromised, et cetera, are really what's at stake right now.
Now that the university has opened, what do you think is a good path forward now that it actually has, classes have started?
You know, in some sense, the damage has been done. So now that students are here, and that's where I do agree with Dr. Carroll, now that the students are here, they're going to do what students do. I'm not sure what the university can do at this point. This was sort of the critical point where a decision had to be made. Keeping mask requirements for campus, of course, is important, but also just providing some of their testing to the community would be an incredible step. Helping students who are in financial distress through COVID, allowing students a lot of flexibility to take care of their families right now. That's really the best we can do. Sort of this critical point for preventing the spread of COVID is already passed in some regard.
Your own personal experience as a graduate student, how has it been going back to university in this fall?
It's been anxiety-inducing. I have one in-person class that was really important for me to take as part of my, you know, building a theoretical basis for my work. And going to campus as somebody who has had COVID, and I could get it again. I don't totally understand the research on that. It's just knowing that even being 6 feet apart, I could touch the wrong doorknob or sit at the wrong table, and I could get it again. And it could take me 20 days to recover, or maybe it would be worse. There's a lot of anxiety around being on campus and knowing that not everybody's wiping down every desk perfectly, and not everybody's wiping down the door handle after they use it. It's still a place where COVID will spread.
With all of these medical experts providing the university with their expertise, the university decided to open. I guess I'm asking you to perhaps speculate here, but why do you think the university decided to open in person?
I mean, I think a lot of that is probably economic. I have immense sympathy for the university. I think it is an important educational institution. But I also think at the end of the day, a crisis like this means that we must suspend business as usual. And in that sense, the university is caught in a bind because their duty is to provide a certain caliber of education, but also a more broad college experience. They wouldn't spend so much money on football and basketball games, for example, if there wasn't a broader experience that they feel the duty to provide. And what it would take right now to sort of revolutionize education at IU is so massive. And it's hard to say what it looks like, but there needed to be more sort of radical moves or more sort of groundbreaking moves. and a willingness to depart from business as usual. And that is a really hard tendency to foster for an institution that is celebrating its 200th year.
Well, Brady Haberlin, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a joy.
Up next, a few minutes with the mayor. In today's segment, Mayor John Hamilton answers questions about Chief Dekoff's denial of systemic racism in Bloomington Police Department, reports of officers not wearing masks, and the shutdown of Greek organizations at IU due to a spike in COVID-19 cases. All that and more in today's edition of A Few Minutes with the Mayor. Community members posted questions on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, posing questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about current issues. Today, on A Few Minutes with the Mayor, John Hamilton answers these questions. So our first question today is from Aaron, and they are asking, after hearing Chief Dekoff say that systemic racism doesn't exist in our city police force, what is the mayor doing to confront and dismantle this naive and damaging mindset?
Chief Dekoff himself made statements after the hearing that clarified, of course, he recognizes, as do I, that systemic racism exists in the police department, in every part of our community, and in every part of our country. We have systemic racism that's a legacy of our history that we all have to deal with. And he said that many times, and he said it again to clarify that. And I certainly have said it many times. Racism is deep in our history, and it still is a legacy that we all have to confront. It's a very present challenge. Now, I'm very proud of our police department and the work that they do, just like I'm proud of our public education system and proud of our healthcare system, but we all have improvements that we need to make to get better.
And there have been several reports of officers not wearing masks while interacting with the public on the job. Are officers exempt to wearing face coverings while interacting with persons within 6 feet of them?
Bloomington police officers have a protocol requiring mask wearing in a number of situations, including if they're indoors with individuals and including if they're within 6 feet of individuals outdoors. They do not need to wear masks when they're alone in their patrol cars. They generally patrol in single member cars. And there are exemptions noted in the record for exigent circumstances, emergency circumstances, or if there are other particular reasons to be concerned about wearing a mask in a particular event. But I'm confident and have seen normal compliance with all these. Now, I've said before, we have rules that require people who are filling potholes and people working at water plants and people in the parks department to wear masks, and we don't get is 100% compliance 100% of the time. But we've seen our city employees do terrific work to adjust how they work and to adopt these new safety measures. And I'm really pleased that they're serving the public so well, including the police.
And will there be any repercussions for officers or even city employees who just don't wear masks or disregard this mandate?
Well, any city employee who does not comply with city policies is subject to normal HR, human resources, and oversight accountability, sure. And that is the case for mask wearing, just like it is for steel-toed boots or hard hats or safety vests or other kind of equipment like that. So we're very cognizant of the importance of that. We have a whole risk management section of our city government that tries to help make sure we mitigate those risks, and we take that very seriously every day.
And would that be the same process then for officers, just through HR?
It would be. It's typically through their department first, and HR is involved with that, as is risk management, which is part of the legal department. And if any employee is not complying with regulations for their employment, their department would be the initial place for feedback on that and discipline if needed. And it usually does implicate human resources, too. And if they're subject to a collective bargaining agreement, that has protocols, too, for how discipline is handled.
Well, our next set of questions comes from the user K Renee, and the first question they ask is, after hitting over 1,000 new COVID-19 cases in Monroe County, and they're saying this is more than on August 26th than the peak in April, how is Bloomington supposed to address the issue of cases continuing to increase exponentially?
Well, we're monitoring the cases daily. We have regular meetings between the health department, Indiana University, county officials, city officials. It's a very serious threat, to be sure. We are not out of the woods. We continue to have a low incidence of positivity rate in the county, below 3%. That's a good thing, significantly lower than the state and the nation averages. But as has been indicated, we have areas of concern too. One of the reasons is the county and the university took particular steps on Greek houses was an indication of some increases in cases in Greek residential halls, residential facilities. One of the reasons we moved forward at the city and that I signed an executive order as mayor to limit private gathering sizes was concerned about some of these larger gatherings that concerned us. It's true, we need to be very careful. We need to all be masked. We need to all avoid super spreader events. We can continue the local ordinances that are close to local rules that are tighter than the state on bar and restaurant behaviors, not allowing bar seating, not allowing congregating, those kinds of things. And we're going to keep monitoring daily and appreciate everybody's, I know it's tired. We've been 6 months into this almost, and we're not out of the woods yet, but we got to keep vigilance, wear those masks and avoid the super spreader events and stay home if you feel sick.
K. Renee User also asked a question about Greek organizations, asking why are they allowed to have parties when they're supposed to be quarantined from IU?
Well, there are 8 houses that are quarantined by IU that are not allowed to have parties at present. And the other several dozen are required to keep those parties, any gatherings, under 15 for private social gatherings and guests. And they're required to seek approval if they're going to do anything different from that. And even in those gatherings, they're required to have masks and physical distancing. So now there are regulations put in place recently by the county health department to require those congregate living facilities like Greek houses to be very vigilant, are serious, and they will have, they do have the force of regulations now. And I know the university is using their authority as a dean of students to help manage those behaviors.
And their next question is, why are COVID-19 related deaths down? Is this because most of the new cases are young IU students?
Well, we do have in Monroe County, we're seeing a substantial number of the cases that are diagnosed and tested are younger people. Of course, we have a high percentage of younger people in the community. And a good thing is we are not seeing a big rise in fatalities. That's very good. But the community spread is what we really are having to be careful about nonetheless, and that is to try to do all that we can to diminish that growth of the virus throughout the community, because it can get more vulnerable populations then. So we can't take our foot off the pedal that is controlling the potential community spread.
And the last question that I have for you today is from user K. Renee as well. And they're asking, at what point does the mayor plan to step in if IU's reopening continues to be the largest outbreak of 2020 in the Bloomington community?
We're working regularly with IU to monitor what they're finding out. You know, they're very aggressively testing. They've tested more than 30,000 people, which is an order of magnitude more than we've tested in the community as a whole. And they are going to continue to test thousands of people a week. So we're working very closely with them to identify risk points, decision points. It's one reason we've taken actions even in the last few weeks to cut the size of gatherings. It's the reason that the county health department took the actions on the congregate living facilities and the quarantines and to put those guidelines into regulations now. So we're going to be constantly communicating with them. There's no single number that will indicate a particular change in approaches, but we're looking at a whole group of indicators and listening to the science. That's what this is about.
Do you have a question for Mayor John Hamilton? Comment that question on this coming week's post for a few minutes with the mayor to have your question answered. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.